Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab, and joined with me is someone that has been doing the intros when I'm not sitting in this chair. I've actually kind of taken his chair to some extent. Welcome back, Terrence.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tyler. This is my fifth time on the show.
Five-timer.
Five-timer. No longer in the quarterback seat, as I mentioned earlier. Now I'm a receiver, so.
Well, next time we're going to have to, we can switch chairs. We can trade back and forth. We'll kind of find our way as we go, but. Thanks for filling in all the different times. This was the original idea of the Publisher Lab a long time ago, was we have so many knowledgeable people in this building. It doesn't make sense to just, you know, listen to one person talk. So, you know, we wanted to go over sort of like the stuff that's important and just kind of like, have a group of folks that sort of like, you know, weighed in on these different things. But, you know, before we kind of get into the news of the day, kind of looking back on some of the things that you've, you know, had on the shows that you've been hosting and things like that. What sticks out to you is like maybe just sort of like, you know, what kind of feels like the topic of the moment? I know AI has been big this year, but I guess like underlying that, like what types of things have stuck out to you this year?
I think the main thing that has stuck out to me is this pace of change. So for example, we're working in the publishing industry. It's, you know, I guess at the start, it's pretty simple. It's just you have a website with content. And now it looks like the whole paradigm is shifting. And a lot of the topics we have been covering have kind of touched on this paradigm shift that's happening. So it might come off like, oh, you know, your website is going to lose all your traffic, or, oh, this is, you know, a different way to produce content. And I feel like that has always underpinned a lot of what has been on the show, just from like a larger scale perspective.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when you think about a lot of publishers, especially the ones that I think listen to this show, it's there is always this sort of like, fear of, you know, we know that innovation, especially in technology, occurs in publishing. It's been a constant if you go back in time. And so it is sort of that feeling of like, you know, you're on an island and you know that the island is kind of sinking. And you're always kind of like keeping your eyes on the horizon to figure out, you know, where's the next, you know, safe place to live. And I think that in our industry as well, you know, I think waiting around until the island is underwater has been traditionally not the best one. So I think you're right. I think the rate of change is probably accelerating some anxiety to just probably generally in publishing.
Yeah. And, you know, when I first came into the industry, one of the first things I heard was things move fast. Things are always changing. You have to always adjust your mindset for whatever is coming. And I feel like what we're seeing now is that speed has ramped up. And because of that, maybe the island's not sinking, but the islands are just moving around a lot faster.
Yeah.
And because of that, it just takes the person or the person behind that website needs to be a little more agile in their thinking, their planning on how they're just running their business in general.
Yeah.
So I feel like because of that, since the speed is changing, it causes, as you said, a lot of anxiety, a lot of nervousness. People are worried about their business. And I feel like, you know, anything we can give a publisher to help them navigate this ever-moving and faster-moving environment, it's just helpful at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think one of the things that, you know, is a positive from innovation in general is that oftentimes things are thought of as like, oh, well, innovation means things get more complex or, you know, there's new technology introduced. And I think that that's not true. I think innovation generally means something that exists today. A problem usually is solved in a more simple way.
Yep.
And I think when you think about our space right now, you know, I think for publishers that make websites and make content, the complexity has been rising. And I think part of the reason for that is because a lot of things in the current environment have been adapting to a changing publishing environment.
Yeah.
You know, there was no YouTube 20 years ago, really, that you had to compete with for attention for an audience. And now YouTube and video is right there next to, you know, written content. And if you think about what it means to be a video publisher now, it's like, you know, 20 years ago, you were making indie movies or, you weren't uploading videos to the internet. So that got way simpler.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that's really important is to recognize if you're a publisher that, you know, anytime there's innovation, if it feels like things are moving away from you, it's not that publishing or content is something that people don't want anymore. I mean, there's more than ever.
It's a growing demand.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, keep your eyes out for where is it getting easier? And that's generally where things are, you know, where the innovation is occurring. And speaking of innovation, we've got a big one from one of our favorite I guess, topics here, or I guess they're a topic and a company, and there are a lot of things. It's our good friends at Google, and they have released Gemini, which has been much Bollywood. I've always seen that written down, but I don't think I've ever said it.
Bollywood?
Yeah.
No, I've never heard that.
Never heard it?
No.
Well, maybe somebody in our audience has, because I've definitely read that before, and it's a real word. So this generative AI model is expected, has been expected for quite a while now. Yep. And Google admits recently that this viral video that they put out of like a demo of it, it wasn't real. And I mentioned to you earlier, like, you know, they admitted it after it was pointed out that it was an edited and kind of like pre-recorded video. But yeah, I mean, I guess first shot at looking at Gemini, what do you think, Terrence?
So how I see it is, they're still playing catch up, and you know, the presentation with like, hey, the video is edited, we actually use a ton of text prompts in the background and sped it up, that tells me they are trying to showcase something that isn't quite there yet. They want to have this like multimodal language model where you can put in text, you can put in voice, you can put in video, and it can answer back in all of the different, you know, modals as well. But it's not quite there. And for example, this morning I was on ChatGPT and I was like, generate me an image of a bird. Boom. I'm gonna bark. Couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And then I asked it to describe, you know, what it just generated, right? And all my answers in ChatGPT felt a little bit better and more like user-friendly than what Bart had. So how I see it is they're still playing catch up, and I don't actually like, you know, hate that they try to go fast here, because, you know, they're trying to catch something that's ahead of them. So them showcasing, you know, something that's better than it actually is kind of makes sense to create hype and get people
for sure
to use their product. So I don't hate that aspect of it, but it doesn't actually work as well, you know, at the end of the day. And now they have this backlash of PR that they have to deal with. And then if you think about their first product launch when it came to AI, same thing, felt rushed.
Oh, yeah.
So now reputation is going to be building that Google's behind, they're rushed, they're not quite there.
Yeah.
So because of that, it's going to make it even harder for them to catch that market share that OpenAI has captured.
And if you think about it too, for all the uses that you would probably like want to dominate the market in for AI, so you think about personal assistant for consumers and then also business applications, you know, those are both instances where you're going to want to be the best. Like if me, you, and Manny all have different AIs on our phones that are, you know, essentially doing a lot of just, you know, nascent tasks and things like that that, you know, occur in our lives, and having it automate stuff. Like, do you want the best one? Like
100%.
Probably, yeah. Right? And the choice is probably not going to be cost prohibitive for any of us. Same can be said for business applications. If you're a business and you're relying on your employees using an AI, like, I would be hard pressed to believe that any business is going to mm-hmm. choose to have one that's worse. So at best, they're going to have to be competitive here. And I think one of the things to think about with this as well is that, you know, Google was way ahead here, or was thought to be way ahead here than everybody else. And they've kind of squandered the last decade. They had the acquisition of DeepMind and different things like that. And it kind of goes to show that I think this is the case with everything in this sort of arena right now, which is no one party, even OpenAI, ChatGPT, is going to be able to control the timeline or the cadence at which different aspects of this occur. It's evolving right now. If OpenAI says, oh no, I think this is too dangerous, let's hold it back, somebody else is going to make that progress. Exactly. And I think Google ran into the same problem where I think they thought, we're going to release AI in the way that we see it. But
then someone comes along,
yep,
the other person, and just releases a way better product.
Yep. And I think that messes up your plans too. So now they're in second place and they're trying to play somebody else's game. And I think that that's a dangerous place to be.
And just to add on that point, I also think that Google has been focused on profits a little too much lately, you know, with their cash cow of Google search. And this is sort of like counterintuitive to that. They basically have to cannibalize their search in order to get this to work, you know, on scale. So now it's like, okay, they have to shift that profit mindset back into a best product for the customer or end user And if you look back, that's how Google Search did start.
Yeah.
It was, how do we make the best product for our end user? And now it's this huge, you know, money generation machine that they're like so used to working. Well, they're like, well, this has to change completely and go back to that principle.
Yeah.
So I think they can do it. It's just going to take time. But what that means is they're already behind.
Yeah.
So the adoption is going to come better from their competitors.
Yeah. And it's always easier to kind of adapt as a smaller company as well. And I agree with that sentiment. And I think you're right. When you're trying to build the best product, you're going to end up in the best positions rather than following the profits, which makes this next story actually really interesting to me, which is it's basically an extension of how Google plans to use Gemini. Gemini is something that they envision actually rolling into their devices. So being able to, on Android phone, basically Google thinks that people want Gemini to tell them their life story. That's actually coming from a CNBC article. Is there anything we're missing here, Producer Manny? This story comes to us from CNBC. What other details did they give us around, you know, what Gemini and this sort of like life story thing includes?
Yeah, so Google's new project is called Project Elman, which is named after Richard David Elman. It aims to transform the way that we view our life stories. In this project, it's proposing using AI language models like Gemini to weave comprehensive narratives from users' mobile data. Imagine having your life story narrated by AI, identifying patterns and key moments from your photos and search history. Project Elman could integrate with Google Photos, offering chat features similar to ChatGPT.
Any of you guys use Google Photos, by the way?
I do not know.
No. I use Apple Photos.
Yeah, me too. Keep going.
But similar to ChatGPT, but with a personal touch, providing insights into your preferences, habits, and significant life events. As Google and other tech giants like Apple delve deeper into AI-driven personal memory creation, they face the challenge of balancing this advanced technology with user privacy and control. This project represents a significant step into how we interact with our digital memories and potentially revolutionizing the way we organize and understand our personal histories. So do you think that you're comfortable with letting your phone basically tell you your life story?
See, how I think about this is how often do you actually look through your old photos? Personally, not very often for me.
Yeah.
I am an Apple user, and Apple will occasionally show like memories from previous photos or places I've been. And it gives me like a nostalgic feeling. Oh, I remember that happened, or I remember that trip. Remember that experience with my friends and family. And I would say probably once a year, I would go through my photos to kind of relive those memories. So I feel like the use case for this is a little bit more niche. Like I could see this working really well for like, you know, a celebration of life for someone.
Yeah.
You know, don't forget this person for X, Y, Z reasons, which means you could have like a digital imprint of yourself once you're already past this world, you know?
Yeah.
So I could see that having significant applications. But for the day-to-day, most people live their lives and just want to live it in experience rather than looking at past memories. Of course, you know, occasionally they'll want to reminisce or get that nostalgic feeling.
I think immediately of the thing that you just mentioned, you know, when we were talking about this in the context of Google releasing it, which is like the direction. So like, my first thought is, you know, that meme where it's like, you know, Google, and then it's like nobody, and then it's just like nothing. That's sort of like, that's how I think of something like this, because I look at it and I'm going, you know, even just the way that it's described in headlines, and I get that it's trying to draw people in with sort of this like doomsday sort of like positioning of AI. But I do think to myself, like, who wants this?
You know? Exactly.
Especially from Google products, you know, because Apple sort of does a little bit of this now. And I don't think anybody is naive enough to think that if you have a Google account or an Apple phone and you run most of your life through it, that it doesn't already know quite a bit about you.
Yeah.
And so when I look at this, you nailed it with the use case, which is like, what a not like, you know, if I'm going to hit somebody with like a fire feature from my brand new, you know, like announcement, this one feels like not something that like people wanted or needed. And they're like, all right, you know, if you would have told me, look, we're going to start tracking your credit cards and every financial transaction. But with that information, what we're going to do is we'll know exactly how much milk you've got. And when you run out of milk, like, we'll use the information from your camera or something like that to create a grocery list for you every day. Or we can just order it. Exactly. You know, it's like, I'm like, man, that's really convenient. Even though it's a little doomsday, I might be willing to let it do it.
And just speaking from like a business standpoint here, how I see this is like, how much data does Google have? And I feel like their biggest data repository is their YouTube collection, right? They probably have the biggest data repository of video data anyone in the world, right? Now, this product looks like it might not even use that. It's using a phone, but their competitor, Apple, probably has a much larger repository of personal photos that users put onto their Apple phone because Apple has such a larger share of the market. So I believe because of this, it doesn't make sense to capitalize on that data stream when if I saw Google release a product, say, hey, turn any, you know, story, article or series of photos into a, you know, full-fledged movie production, that would make a lot more sense to me from them leveraging their data sources that they have.
It's exactly where I was going with this and where I'm thinking that publishers might be able to kind of keep an eye on, you know, innovations like this and probably some that I would guess that Amazon and Meta and probably Apple as well are working on. And that's the idea that your phone is, you know, part of what you do as a content creator today is you take information and then you, like, you're the filter for everybody else. And in many cases, our publishers are experts. And so one of the things that you think about with AI is the same process works. The thing is, you're almost like a sensor out into the world, gathering information and then bringing it back to everybody. But if your phone can help you with that, where it's automatically capturing, whether it's your, you know, a travel writer and it's traveling, it's marking all the spots on a map as you go, and you can sort of like navigate through that and have it generate, you know, help you generate content or media or something like that that's related to things that you've done, but not necessarily have to write down or log or something on your own. Automation for that sort of thing, I think, has a lot of promise.
So, your question: would you say for a travel blogger, Tyler, this would be super helpful?
Yeah, I mean, this just based on what we know about it, no, you know, and that I think that that's why I struggle to see sort of like the direction in this. But I do know that you probably anything that you can dream of with AI right now, there's somebody that's working on it, and probably more than one. And so that's where I think it's probably really important to keep an eye out. And most of these things will probably fall into a bucket where the Googles or the Apples of the world will be some type of gatekeeper for the stuff that's the most significant. So, you know, is it Gemini? I won't say probably not, but I'll just say that, you know, like there'll be something there.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
So we got another story in the world of AI. This one featuring two, I would say, like, folks that are bringing up the rear, if you were to ask those in the world of technology, you know, who's leading the way. These are two names. One is a blast from the past, and one is, you know, in and out of the news, but not necessarily for leading the way in AI, and that is IBM and Meta. So for those of you that are under the age of 30, IBM is a technology company. They used to be a really successful one. And they've spent exponential amounts. I cannot describe to you the amount of advertising dollars that IBM spent on, wait for it, Watson. Have you ever heard of Watson?
I've heard about it.
Most of our listeners, I think, might be familiar with it just because of the ad campaign. But for 20 years, it feels like IBM has been advertising Watson's AI, and they still use that name. But I don't know anyone that thinks of IBM as a leader outside of government circles. While they have some pretty good government contracts, I think, on things like defense, probably more so back office stuff. They formed an AI alliance with Meta, the sort of like musical chairs of all the big tech companies in AI and their partnerships and their innovations. Meta got left with IBM. And so they've formed this AI alliance now with 50 other organizations to promote open source AI. Manny, what is this open source AI that they're talking about here, this alliance? What does it mean?
So you're right that they Meta and IBM have joined forces to form an AI alliance. They're bringing together over 50 influential organizations, including tech giants like AMD and Intel, research powerhouses like NASA and CERN, and esteemed academic institutions like Harvard. This alliance marks a pivotal moment in AI history, championing the cause of open innovation and open source. It stands in an ideological contrast to the closed AI systems of companies like OpenAI and Google. The AI Alliance is set to reshape the AI landscape by promoting transparency, collaboration, and sharing valuable tools, knowledge, and research. Its initiatives span developing AI benchmarks, nurturing an AI hardware accelerator ecosystem, supporting global AI research endeavors, and advocating for diversity in AI foundation models. This collaboration represents a crucial ideological battle in AI development, emphasizing open source principles. The impact of the AI Alliance on the future of AI development is poised to be significant, potentially influencing the direction of AI and innovation globally. So it seems like they're going to be trying to do a lot of what we heard a few months ago, that Congress was meeting with a bunch of tech leaders and that they were going to try to push innovation forward and kind of set regulations on AI. And this seems to kind of like, I don't know if it's circumventing that or just kind of like working alongside it, where they're going to be setting their own kind of principles for AI and potentially, like, in a way, kind of doing what the video game industry did in the 90s with the ESRB, where they're trying to just regulate themselves.
So yeah, I love open source just in general. I go back and forth on this one a little bit. I'll say this. There's almost no instance where I can imagine a scenario in which you're able to keep engineers around the world from being able to
build things.
And like I was saying earlier about the innovation, and you know, it's very hard to control and say, like, we're only going to allow innovation to occur here, and then we're going to contain it. You know, I think that that's wishful thinking and not realistic. But as it relates to AI, you know, if you compare it to, maybe let's consider it, you know, dangerous in the wrong hands. You think about something like nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are one of the only innovations that's ever occurred in modern history, in which it essentially is something that's proprietary to a number of countries. Part of that is through treaties. Other part of that is the minerals and the materials that it takes to produce them. And then also the methods, the refinement, things like that. They're very hard to do. And yeah, it's something to where it's like, it's very obvious when it's occurring. And so people are able to do something about that. AI is arguably more stealth, but I would say also equally hard to do successfully without the use of somebody else's, you know, sort of like backbone. So I do understand a little bit of the apprehensiveness, but I also don't believe that it's reality that you'll be able to not have this be something that is in some form or fashion open source.
Yeah. So how I see this is, as someone young growing up, whenever I hear like a company joining with other companies to create an organization for safety, I immediately think it's more PR than actual action.
Mm-hmm.
So that is always my first thought. And then just
that's absolutely what this is.
Yeah. 100%. Right. Now, touching on the points of, you know, the actual dangers of the stuff, as you mentioned, nuclear weapons, for example, right? It takes, you know, a government to get that assembled.
Yeah.
Now let's look at what an individual can do with an AI model, right? So there's open source AI models already out there. Yes, they're not as powerful as the current models like ChatGPT, Gemini, and whatever else is out there. And then the next thing that's needed is not just the software, but the hardware. So all the GPUs, the process, and train these models. That does come at a cost.
Yeah, it does get pretty cost prohibitive. I set a table in my house on fire running an AI model that was probably prohibitive to most people to run, just because of the amount of data or data storage that you would need, you know, personally just to have that.
Yeah, so for example, let's say it costs you $1 million to train an AI model, right?
Yeah.
There's your bar venture right there. But anyone could technically do that,
yeah,
you know, with the right means. So, you know, having an, I guess good standards and maybe education about how to develop safe technology is good. So then when those future engineers and innovators come into the space, they're a little bit smart about it and not just rushing.
Yeah.
However, this won't do anything with the speed of AI we see from ChatGPT and Google. That arms race is happening at those competitors. It's not going to slow anything down because each company is going to try to stay ahead of their competition.
Correct. Yeah, and I think it becomes one of those things where it's an arms race, you know, where, you know, if you think about it, you've got, it's going to be these, the innovation is going to occur at the front. And so if you've got a lesser AI model or engine, you know, it can get outcompeted. It's kind of like having a, you know, a first generation fighter jet versus a fifth generation one. It's like, yeah, your enemy may have a first generation one, but the second you put your fifth generation one out there, it's gonna take it out. And I think, you know, any AI that can do any kind of bad, if it's less advanced than one that is,
someone can just specialize and make it specific for, I guess, a bad action.
Yeah, so I think your general bad actors are gonna be something that is not something too much to worry about. I see why this is in Meta and IBM's best interest, because, you know, what they want to do here is they want to level the playing field so that everybody is catching up at the same time. They don't want the OpenAI scenario now where you have one party that's like clearly ahead of everyone else and leading the way. And you can make the argument too that that's, you kind of want that a little bit for just global fairness and different things like that. But that being said, you know, sort of what that looks like to you is going to be pretty subjective depending on, you know, your geopolitical slants and, you know, what country you live in and a whole host of other things. So,
yeah, I mean, to me, it sounds like, you know, if you ever play sports and some kid is like maybe better than everyone else, maybe he's an extra year older than you. Like, all right, let's put an age restriction on this. Yeah. So we don't have to play, you know, against this kid that's way better. I think it's kind of a similar dynamic that happens. It's like, OpenAI is the big kid on the block. Yep. Everyone's like, well, what can we do to pull them back in, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like maybe he can only play left tackle.
You know? Exactly.
So we've got, you know, we just mentioned OpenAI and we've got another story that comes to us from SEO Roundtable, and it's, is OpenAI's ChatGPT, GPT-4 getting lazier? So I told you both before the show, and I think I maybe mentioned it on a previous episode. It absolutely is. It's getting worse. It's not just you. And part of the reason, and nobody really knows for sure why. OpenAI, I'm guessing the engineers there have some guesses. But the problem that this is not an easy one to solve, because part of it is a scale. Part of it potentially is a scaling thing. The other is potentially they're both essentially that. So the theories go like this. One is that if you remember the early days of ChatGPT, it was down all the time.
Yeah.
It would say, come back, it's the servers are busy, you know, like whatever. And it would oftentimes like error out whenever you try to ask it something and it limited you. And it's because running AI in the cloud at scale for everybody is very, very cost prohibitive, intensive. I mean, even now it's like it won't complete certain tasks and you have to ask it a bunch of times to actually complete it because it's trying so hard to save memory and save data. So there's not enough computing power available right now to scale it the way that they need to. And so it's self-limiting its memory and things like that so that it can basically provide all customers with, you know,
the product. Answer.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then the second theory, and these two things don't have to be exclusive, is that as it grows and grows in complexity and sort of like bandwidth, you can't have this be one thing. If you want to distribute it to people, you think about, like, let's imagine it takes, you know, 30 by 30 square feet of hardware to host ChatGPT in its entirety. As it keeps growing and getting larger and larger, if you have to put one of those bad boys, like, you know, in every major city just so that people can access it at scale, it becomes not only incredibly expensive, but very hard to update and a bunch of other things. So one of the things that's been thought of for a long time is you start to break these models apart so that they're a little bit more independent of each other. So that's where you have, like, you've got the create your own GPT thing now. Yep. You've got, like, you know, OpenAI, if you have the pro version, you can select which model you want to use. So a lot of the Stable Diffusion stuff works the same way. And the reason is because those are smaller. It's not one GPT. It would actually be ideal to have them all combined for a general purpose GPT. And so not having access to, you know, the complete model, it's going to have these like weird gaps in context and different things like that. And so that's one of the other theories as to why it's gotten worse. But I don't know. Have you noticed this sort of like worsening of ChatGPT here as of late?
In my personal experience, I have, but it's more subtle, I believe, than how it's made out to be.
Yeah.
And I do agree with your framing that, you know, this comes down to scaling and basically computational usage, right? It could also come down to resources from OpenAI too, right? If they're trying to limit bandwidth per user, then it says, hey, limit bandwidth per user, but still give the user an answer. So that answer that comes out might be a little bit more lazier,
mm-hmm.
but it's not going to be the same for all queries. Maybe there's some queries that are more optimized, right? And I think another part is, you know, a large language model is trained on, you know, massive corpus of data, and its answer is basically the average of that. So, you know, you could see this almost as a regression to the mean a little bit.
Yeah.
Right. You know, maybe when it first came out, it started off having a bit more variability in those answers. And then now over time, it's regressing to a mean.
Yeah.
And that mean comes off as lazier or more vanilla or more boring of an answer.
Yeah.
So then they say, oh, ChatGPT is getting lazy. So it could be another that second theory is part, I think, could be the reason. But I do agree a lot. It's probably on the limitation of the hardware.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I think the regression thing is a really important aspect of this as well. And I think that becomes a really hard choice if you're a engineer as well. And I think for the broader GPTs of the world, they are going to always sort of like slant that way. When you start to get more specific models, it makes more sense for it to have like much more of a creative or opinionated sort of response. But yeah, like you think about something like, I mean, I think this is a temporary problem regardless. I mean, you think about the early days of the internet, there were many things that were predicted, many wrong about where the internet might take us, but many that were very easy to see the writing on the wall that people would shop and buy things online. Unfortunately, we really didn't have the infrastructure to support. I mean, even then we couldn't have imagined sort of this mobile sort of like connectedness that we've got now. But it just took a while for the hardware and the infrastructure that we have both domestically and here in the United States and globally to support, you know, sort of like the software really that we've been able to build.
Yep.
And then I think we've spent the last 20 or 30 years in software innovation, and AI may be kind of like the cap to that. And I think after this, the real innovation is going to need to come in both hardware and energy.
I think this also touches on a really important point, which is the cost of using these models. Because when ChatGPT first came out, it was like, oh, this is expensive to generate an answer. Are they going to make a profit off it? Is Google going to make a profit if every search query runs on this? And the answer was no, right? So I think what's happening with all the competition with the different companies also generating their own chips, right? They're optimized for these language models, is the cost to run these models is dramatically dropping.
Yep.
So this story is kind of, I think, just like a flash in the pan. It'll go away because we have this massive trend where cost is going to go basically to zero.
Yeah.
And when costs go to zero, and you have all these different models and different companies with different specialized chips, then the real question is going to be, what's the platform that these are all going to be running on, and how users going to be interacting with them?
Yeah, and you can already see sort of the split, because, you know, Microsoft is making their own chips, Apple's starting to make some of theirs, and in Microsoft's reveal of their chip, one of the things that, you know, everybody is racing to get, you know, the most advanced chips, which can really only be made from like one foundry, and you've got NVIDIA who's kind of leading the way. And if everybody has to have NVIDIA chips that are, you know, come from Taiwan's manufacturing plant, then, you know, you're going to really struggle to sort of scale this quickly. And I think one of the things that Microsoft revealed was that when you have a specific model with different needs, you don't necessarily need to have the most advanced chip. You just need one that's very much catered to doing this sort of like processing and machine learning that, you know, your software supports. And that's what we know with other technologies. And your point about it going to zero, it's like, do you remember, I remember 2 years ago, and I think the early days of ChatGPT, before it was even released to the public, you bought everything on credits. You had so many credits, and they kind of started that way a little bit too. And it reminds me of cell phones whenever you would have a data plan or a minutes plan even before that. And I think that, you know, that's partially because the running it on old infrastructure was expensive. But now that you have new infrastructure, cell phone towers, things like that, it gets a lot cheaper to, I mean, like, does anybody have a data plan where you pay
no, per data? No, limited everything.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure most people are probably in that bucket now.
Yeah, I didn't realize ChatGPT had a credit plan. I do know a lot of like third party services I use for like image generation and other things. They all have credit plans too, but I could clearly see that going away once the cost drops.
Yeah. I remember whenever it was just a development platform for a little while, it was all very much credit based, and it was almost like, I remember showing it to my partner here at Azoic and telling him like, hey, this actually is really good. Cause it was as good as you see with ChatGPT, you know, 2 years ago. The only thing is you had to very much specialize the prompt. Like you had to put it into context and pick the right model. And then, but we were looking at it and I'm like, look, you asked it for, you know, to write you a bunch of phrases for this thing. And look how many credits it used. It was like $1.22 or something like that. And he's like, you know, to run this at scale, you just can't. It's just so cost prohibitive. I don't know who they think is going to use this. And obviously, they got the cost down. You know, Microsoft with $40 billion
keep going down too.
Yeah, yeah, it's 100% true. And I think that we'll continue to see that sort of thing occur. And speaking of data and sending it over the airwaves, the FTC, who's the federal agency here in the United States, tasked with regulating such communications. They're very much interested in returning to a throwback, if you will, of Meta's use of personal data. So do you remember Cambridge Analytica?
Yeah, they had that. They're featured in a documentary, The Social Dilemma. And basically, if I remember correctly, they took a ton of data from Facebook users and looked at which users were on the edge for voting for which party.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone's like 51% Republican, 49% Democratic, they would have specialized targeted ads for those key individuals who are in specific states to swing the vote. And they would target ads to those swing votes in order to win the state.
Yeah. And to put this in the context for publishers, and you nailed it, by the way. So think about it this way. If you were running ads on your website and advertisers were just like, hey, I want to put ads on your website. You're like, bring them on in.
Yep.
And all of a sudden you found out that some of the ads that one of the advertisers was putting on your website, they actually weren't ads, but they were Trojan horses. And what they were doing is they were actually cooking your users and saving their data. So the whole value of you being there so that the advertiser can show ads to your users.
Mm-hmm.
And they can retarget people and stuff like that through you. They're actually collecting the same data that you are, and then they're using that information to then go advertise to them directly or
reselling
it somewhere else. And so, you know, essentially what would be occurring there is an advertiser mining your users' data, which is something that they've maybe consented to with you, but not with the advertiser. And so because of that, I can see why the Federal Trade Commission, in this case, you know, consumers in many, many ways are like the visitors of the United States' webpage.
Yeah.
Is a fun way to look at it. And so, you know, I know that Facebook has actually done a lot of stuff that they've been trying to regulate themselves and find out, like, they keep kind of coming back, I feel like, and going, is this good enough? Is this what you want? And then them saying no, and then them going, okay, changing something else. I just know that whenever I run Facebook ads these days, it's every 3 months I get some kind of email notification that says like all my audiences data like has to change and I have to fix them all because they've shifted something to make something more private.
Yep.
But I don't know that consumers are necessarily banging on the door for this. I think consumers see all things data or privacy related through a lens of very much a layman, and it all sort of goes in the same box for them. What do you think?
How I see this is, I think it's regulations or government wants to hit big tech as much as they can. We did mention earlier on the show how, you know, all these lawsuits and legal battles are basically attacks on big tech.
Yeah.
And this trend has been going on since these tech companies got massive. You know, you had Google with antitrust, you have Meta with personal data, and I feel like it's going to continue as long as they're top dogs. But you're not going to see a story saying, you know, some mid-tier company like, I can't think of an example right now, but maybe like Adobe having issues with, you know, data of their users, right?
Yeah.
But since they're, you know, the big dog in the room, it just makes it clear for, you know, hitting them. I don't think anything will come of this, honestly. Rather than, you know, whatever fine Meta has to pay, which will be like a drop in the bucket to their revenues. So I don't see it's going to be like a big deal, you know. And also on the note saying, hey, you know, you're profiting off data from users under 18 years old. You know, Meta can clearly just say, we don't track the age of our users.
Yeah.
And then they'll have no idea, you know, the age of that user. So I see there's a lot of ways to get around this. I do think people are still hold a grudge against Facebook.
Yeah.
For their, I guess, proxy role in the 2020 election. And, you know, it's kind of Meta's platform was used to get a result. But is it actually that platform's fully fault? Yeah, maybe they could have been a little bit more tighter on the data privileges given to advertisers. Maybe they could have done a little bit more there. They probably could have. But at the end of the day, I wouldn't hold it against them forever because guess what? We have a new election coming up in 2024. And I bet the same thing's going to happen, but not on Facebook.
Yeah.
It might be on TikTok. Might be on somewhere else.
These things, you know, whatever the platform for communication is going to be, it's going to get exploited in some way or another. And I think, you know, the argument from the FTC would probably just be that Facebook has been a laggard due to incentives for profit to, you know, like be reactive in actually solving the problem versus reactive in responding to criticism. And I think when you look at somebody like Meta or Google and all these antitrust suits that occur, especially from regulators that want to control about user data, I think the one thing that I would tell publishers that maybe seems counterintuitive is you actually want to root for big tech a little bit here. And the reason is because most of the regulations that we've seen that come from municipalities and world governments is that, you know, the big tech companies, nobody understands. I mean, it's very hard to regulate any of these things in general, even if you have a deep expert knowledge of sort of how the inner workings of it. And so you end up with something that's largely broad and sometimes not very well thought through, or, you know, something that's very hard to implement. And so then you're left with the only people that can sort of dictate this implementation or standardize it is big tech. So then you have cookie banners, like, you know,
GDPR comes out and it's impacting the small publisher. Now every small publisher has to have that for EU traffic.
Imagine if you're Facebook and your answer to, you know, the age of users is, well, now everybody has to show a photo ID to get a Facebook account, or you have to verify your identity, otherwise you can't post or something like that. And given the popularity of Facebook, you will have an exodus of some people, but that'll pass on to other platforms. And, you know, is that something that you want? Do you want to give these companies where you already are concerned about your data? Do you want to give them more of it, you know, more of your identity? Because it's going to get exposed. I mean, we saw it a couple of weeks ago with Okta and their, you know, big data breach. So many companies use those servers that it's like there's been this massive release of privacy data and, you know, probably intellectual property and things like that as well. So, I'm concerned about, you know, sort of when regulation actually goes into effect against most of big tech.
And also just like to touch on the point of this data privacy, I'm a believer that the decision should be made for the end user. But a lot of what we're seeing is the end user had no idea what was happening. So now we're trying to make it obvious to the end user. So let's take GDPR, for example, right? You know, if you have traffic from the EU, you must show a consent module that says we're collecting data, cookies, right? And all these consent modules have a clear button that says continue.
Yeah.
And then a very hard to see obscure button that says, let me edit the cookies and disable all the tracking, right? So if you look at the data, guess how many users actually go in and edit that or say reject consent?
Yeah,
probably like 1%. None. Yeah, almost none, right? So most users just want that convenience. And I feel like the general population is now more aware of their data and how it's being shared, but they're still okay with companies using it because they know they get a better, more convenient, you know, higher quality product in return.
And I think a lot of this is obfuscated by the fact that these big tech companies are playing against each other and against these governments as well. And the thing is that most of the data that we're talking about, and as it relates to, you know, the publishers that I think listen to this show largely with websites, is how many consumers do you know that you think care whether or not a website knows? Just the only thing that they know is that they use a Chrome or Safari browser, that they're on mobile or a desktop.
Yeah, most people don't even know.
Outside of an IP address, it's this user agent data, which is basically just like the device, the time of day. Did they come from Google? Did they come from Facebook? I don't care. Like, you know, whenever you fill out those surveys, whenever you buy a product where it's like, how'd you hear about us? It's like, I never feel like I'm giving somebody like, hey, I don't want to, how dare you ask me how I heard about your business so that you can improve it. You know, nobody really cares. I don't think about that data. What you do care about is whenever people start knowing your name, your phone number, you know, information about you personally. And that's kind of, you know, that's the data that these social media companies and Google try to profile. But to run the advertising ecosystem, to do publishing correctly, and to have an ecosystem that is both private and like you're able to operate with user data as a publisher, you don't need this.
No.
Like the data is already private. And I think that that's a little bit of the con here, is that we're led to believe that all user data is bad.
So I will play devil's advocate just slightly, and only based off of an anecdote I had with my friends the other night. And I was explaining to them what I do, right? And I was explaining to them website data. And I was like, okay, so I'll never know the name of any user that goes on one of my websites, right? Yeah. But what I will know is the device they're using, the browser they're using, the geolocation they have, their device, mobile, desktop, tablet. They all know their device height, width, right?
Yep.
And basically, I was telling all these data points that I will know time of day. And I said, what I can do is, instead of knowing your name, I can bucket users, you know, using a unique characteristic of those things.
Yeah.
That will sort of say, hey, this user on, you know, let's say Chrome Mobile 12 p.m. from California is on my site, right? That won't fit a smaller percentage of people. So you can actually get somewhat close without actually knowing the name.
Yeah.
And that is when I saw like my friend's eyes light up. They're like, well, you can do that. And I was like, yeah, that's how most target advertising works. They don't actually know your name. It's just taking a ton of different data points and sort of triangulating it for a person ID almost.
Yeah.
So that will be the flip side of this, but I feel like, you know, most people don't understand
Comfortable with that?
They were comfortable with it. They were just kind of shocked that that's how it actually worked.
Oh, yeah. And that's sort of my interpretation. Yeah, that's exactly my interpretation, is that people are a little bit like, they're layman's when it comes to like what data and how it's collected. I think that people think that it's almost like somebody's hacked into your phone when they're collecting your data or something, like they're secretly spying on you. But it is this user agent data. And I will say, like, an IP address is really what we argue about in most of these regulations, because the IP address is the one piece of information that, combined with everything you just described, allows me theoretically to go, that's Terrence versus that's a guy
in California.
Yeah, exactly.
On Chrome, on an iPhone.
Yeah. Yep. I might be able to even get down to your age and different things like that. And that's where, you know, there's been all these like kind of back channel things and what DSPs do as well. And we get into the weeds when we go down, like when we start saying the word DSP, I feel like. But the thing is that this idea of fingerprinting has occurred for a decade, where it's like you combine enough of what you described over a longer period of time. And I don't necessarily even need an IP, but I'm 99.9% sure that's Terrence.
So you know, this really makes me understand how like strong of a position Google have, for example, because of all the search history data they have. So think about the user agent data with Chrome, iPhone, California, 12 p.m. in the day on this website. Now combine that with all that user's search history, you can probably dial in exactly who that is.
Yep. And Google is the one that's in this strong position too, because, you know, like if there's one application or one like technology that I have on my phone that I don't want to turn off, like learn from my history or behavior from. It's Google. It's like really helpful to start to type in something and then have it autofill the rest of what I'm going to say based on, you know, what it thinks I'm getting ready to search. Or, man, I was at that, well, I was at that place the other day. What was that restaurant we were looking up? Going to my Google Maps. There it was. Boom.
Is the suggestions perfect?
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think that, yeah, it's like, that's one thing where it's like, yeah, I think when the consumer knows the value of something, it's a lot easier to sort of like, the cost of my data. Okay. It's a fair trade for me in the case of Google.
Yeah.
Is it a fair case for me to use an Apple phone? Sure. Sure. You know?
Yeah.
But there's a lot of instances where it's like, you're like, no, why do you need that for this?
Yeah.
You know? And in many cases, like with a Garmin GPS watch, for example, you have to. You have to actually give them access so that they can fulfill EU regulation requirements. And you didn't have to before.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the areas where it's like, this gets a little bit sticky. But
yeah. I mean, as the end user, how I look at it is, if you're getting value from a product or a service, just understand that there's a data going to be used. And how I make that decision is, I'm okay giving up that data in return for some value.
Yeah.
And, you know, so for example, like if I use an app on my phone that provides, let's say, sleeping data, I'm okay giving that to that company because I'm trying to improve my quality of life.
Yeah.
It's a trade-off that I think, you know, most reasonable people are just okay making, and it's not that big of a deal. But I feel like in sense of these regulations, it almost makes it seem bigger than it actually is.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where I think the PR campaign is hard at work here for somebody. Yeah.
Then that is on the AI Alliance now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So there you go. I'm sure there's definitely no ill will or intentions. It's just for, like, you know, ethical use only. But speaking of ethical use only, Terrence, it's been great having you on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on again.
Using, really appreciate it. Using you in an ethical manner to supplement our news of the day and supplement my quarterbacking. But yeah, we'll have to get this dream team together a little bit more often. If our audience, if you guys really enjoyed this show, let us know at thepublisherlab.org. And yeah, any parting words from you if we don't get a chance to talk again on the show before 2024, which is just around the corner?
First of all, I'll say it's a pleasure having me on the show again, Tyler. It's great being on with you too. First time I've been on with you.
I know.
So that was a cool experience.
We kind of like serve the same role. So, you know, hopefully our audience has enjoyed this sort of like power squad here at the end of the year.
Yeah. And I'll say for the audience, if you enjoy it, drop a like, you know, let us know. If there's any specific topics or, you know, let us know too. We'll be happy to cover them.
Yeah. And I will be back here shortly with some more episodes. We won't be doing a roundup, you know, best of episode at the end of the year. I think those suck so much. I just can't do it. And so we've got some really special episodes planned that hopefully just based on feedback that we've gotten and things like that, you'll really enjoy. So we'll catch you next time on The Publisher Lab.